Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. I'm getting up soon
in the morning. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about ways of healing the body. We're going to look at blue-green algae and how it can help you if you have diabetes or metabolic syndrome or if you're overweight. We're also going to look at a very important way to help prevent the flu at any time of the year, and it's something that's delicious. And yoga can reduce the risk factors for cardiovascular disease and much more on health and healing. My guest in the second part of our program today will be Dr. Nancy Ellen Abrams, and we're going to talk about how the cosmological and physical sciences should inform us about our concept of a higher entity and its relevance in facing future challenges. She is a philosopher, historian, and an attorney, and she has a great background in this area. She has a PhD from University of Chicago in history and philosophy of science, plus a JD degree from University of Michigan Law School, and it'll be a very interesting discussion. Her husband, Professor Joel Primack, is a renowned astrophysicist who first co-authored the theory of dark matter and dark energy. Now, in addition to two volumes written with her husband on the social relevance behind the cosmological sciences for transforming the world, she is right on top of social issues. So that'll be a very interesting discussion. I'm allowing a little more time. We will continue with our ongoing honest look at the truth behind the safety and efficacy of vaccines with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, board-certified physician, professor of medicine, published author in the peer-reviewed literature, nephrologist, internist, taking a look at why we should question everything when it comes to vaccines. Also today, our next part on how we got into the mess we are in. I don't know if I'll have time. I wrote a commentary late last night. If we do, it is why we turn our anger inward and it becomes self-destructive. I've seen so many people who are so angry and they look for someone to blame for their anger. They use their subconscious conditioning to attack, to vilify, not realizing it's coming from inside, no matter who they blame. How do we turn that around and use it constructively instead of destructively? If time permits, I'll deal with that. Also, some other issues I wanted to get with today, that we think of California as the dry state. It isn't. There are states that are actually drier, have less water. Even on the East Coast, there are bad conditions, and we should be aware of it, especially for those people who are viewing North Carolina as a good place, or Delaware. Not a good idea for the future. And tomorrow I'll be doing a major debate for 2 hours on vaccines on one of the largest radio stations in California to try to explain to people why they have been lied to. And right now there is a massive campaign underway, well-funded, using MDs and PhDs who engage in trying to sidetrack people by name-calling and ridicule. They emotionalize, they antagonize, they goad opponents. They become incredulous and indignant. They create rumor mongers. They question your motives. They invoke their authority. And yet, today, virtually all the state and federal legislators are ignoring the actual peer-reviewed independent science. So let me put this in this context. Our politicians, with few exceptions, do not care about facts. All they care about are emotions and who's paying them to get their vote. And it's the lobbyist. So we're trying to understand the psychology of this because we have all the facts on our side. All of the science is on our side. They have nothing. They have dead babies. They have a million injured children. They have payoffs, bribes, scandals galore. They have lobbying in behind closed doors. But what they don't have is the truth. And it's time that we understood, if we're going to move this issue forward on mandatory vaccines, we have to have a way of inspiring people to think deeply, because the facts in and of themselves will not win the day. So if you live in Northern California, I'll be debating tomorrow for 2 hours from noon until 2 their time. So listen in. I think you'll find it interesting. Let's begin. I look carefully at the science of a food. Every food has some common phytonutrients and fibers and amino acid patterns. But what I look for is what makes it unique in the phytonutrients. And green algae is just one of the best ingredients out there. A mixture of green algae extracts are now shown to be able to lower your body fat, improve lean muscle mass, and help you if you have diabetes. There was some good research done at University of Southern Queensland, as well as James Cook University and University of Queensland in Australia. And all three of these found that there are bioactive ingredients in the algae that make a difference in our body. So here's the message for this. It doesn't take much to go into Chinatown and look at all the different varieties of seaweeds they have. I would suggest hijiki. And it's very inexpensive. You can buy it in a large bag, far less expensive than in a health food store. You get more of it. And all you do when you get it home is you wash it 3 times. Then you cook it, and then you can use it either hot or cold. But it's loaded with these nutrients that can help your body, including a very important iodine component for your thyroid gland. But we need to get it into our body. Now, the idea that winter is the time of flu is a misnomer. People can get the flu at any time. The flu is not as much about viruses that we would contract, but whether or not our immune system is able to neutralize the viruses. We're exposed to microorganisms every single day of our lives. And for those of us of my generation, the baby boomers, who are allowed to go outside in the morning and play and come back and eat lunch and go back out and play again, and we played in the dirt and we were exposed to nature, and especially when I had the benefit of being exposed to farms, especially in the summertime, you're around animals, you're around everything. Well, your body takes these microorganisms and creates a hearty, healthy, natural immune response. Now, it doesn't mean you can't get sick, but it means your body's much better suited to defending itself because you have so many different antibodies that you have recorded from these small exposures, these dirt and natural bacteria over a period of time. Compared to a kid that's in the city whose mother or father doesn't want them exposed to anything, they're way far more likely to get sick and stay sick. So just remember, we have viruses that can contribute to flu 12 months a year. It's a misnomer to think it's only seasonal. Also, we overbundle up. We don't expose ourselves to natural ventilation and natural air. Apartments are generally cooled or heated by central air or central heat. There's a massive amount of bacteria that builds up in there that people never think. You mean I got to clean it? Yeah, just like you have to clean the air conditioning and heating ducts in your car. Well, I didn't know that. Well, if you took a light and you looked inside and you took a simple ultra blue light and you put it in there, you could see lots of bacteria and molds and fungi growing. And so you take hydrogen peroxide and you spritz it in there, and that can help kill it. And that way, when you turn it on, it's not blowing all that bacteria into your face. So it's very cold outside or very hot outside. So we expose ourselves to the very cold and air-conditioned houses and cars. or very hot in air-conditioned houses and cars. The right way to do it is what my mother did. My mother would bundle us up and put us outside, let us play in the cold. And that built up natural immunity. All mothers did that. Today, children and adults do not spend enough time outside. So if you spend more time outside, you build up natural immunity. Now, this is something else you can add in. A cup of cocoa. That's right. This is from GreenMed Info. It says that when you find your body needs innate immunity, chocolate helps your body obtain that and actually helps against the flu. Quote, in the cell studies, they found that cocoa extract inhibited the flu from taking hold in canine kidney cells. The cells had been infected with human influenza, H1N1 and H3N2 and B viruses, as well as avian viruses, H5N1 and H5N9. So they found that by giving the hot chocolate, that's what it is, for 4 days, that it substantially prevented the effects of the viruses. So how about this? How about just putting some organic chocolate, small amount, 2 ounces, into your body each day? Why? Because it significantly impacts your natural killer cell activity. And natural killer cells are recognized to eliminate influenza virus-infected cells in order to keep the virus from spreading. In other words, your NK cells, that's your natural killer cell activity, is an indicator of the body's natural immunity. So vaccine-induced elevations in antibodies, on the other hand, do not necessarily equate to bona fide immunity against infection, as they're only a proxy measure for effectiveness. The fact that your natural chocolate significantly increases that compared to not having it, and hence inhibiting influenza virus infection by stimulating natural immunity and conferring real protection against the onset of the flu. And there are other studies that confirm that. Also, we found out that natural chocolate, which, by the way, it works because of a bitter component called theobromine, and also the lignin, L-I-G-N-I-N, which is a dietary fiber, and the fat, and it's rich in copper, zinc, and iron. But it lowers blood pressure. It gives you a better heart than statins. It burns belly fat and lowers diabetes risk. And the idea is to have at least 70% dark chocolate without the sugar, preferably raw and organic. So natural ways of helping yourself. Now, like an ecosystem, any ecosystem, our bodies host trillions of bacterial cells that affect everyday life. The human body contains so many bacteria, far more bacteria than we actually have cells. And these are important. They're important because, well, they're made up of bacteria and fungi and protists and viruses, each of which have their own set of unique genes. And together, these microbes, these microflora, they help create what is called the human microbiome. It's a term that is relatively new, but it's being used more frequently. And the human body plays host to trillions of these microbes that all play a fundamental role in keeping you healthy. And this is reported in the American Academy of Microbiology. And there are hundreds of thousands of different types of microbes existing in the world. But only several hundred of them live on humans. And microbes are found all over your body. You've got them on your face, your lips, your skin, your pores, your sweat glands, linings of your nasal passages, your lungs, your digestive tract, and urogenital tracts. And they all play some role. So here's the deal. When you're eating living food like salads, and vegetables and fruits, dried or fresh. When you're drinking juices, healthy juices, beet juice, lemon juice, watermelon juice, you are reading. forcing healthy microorganisms. When your food, like brown rice and grains and walnuts and almonds, again, you reinforce healthy microorganisms. That in terms means that they can migrate throughout the body. So everywhere where you have these trillions of organisms, which is in every cell of your body, you're going to be healthier. And they communicate. There is a message that they send one another. When, however, you take in the sugars, processed sugars, and the dead meats, and refined carbohydrates, and alcohol, and chemicals, you destroy the good microbacteria and microorganisms, and you create harmful ones. When you take antibiotics, you really hurt your immune system. So the more you can do to keep on a healthy living foods diet, the longer you're going to live, the healthier your immune system, and the greater response to any attacks. And finally, more and more people are doing yoga, which is a good thing to reduce cardiovascular disease. This comes from the European Society of Cardiology, published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. Quote, "There is promising evidence that the popular mind-body practice of yoga is beneficial in managing and improving the risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease and is a potentially effective therapy for cardiovascular health. Indeed, following a systematic review of 37 different randomized controlled trials, including 2,768 subjects, investigators from the Netherlands and the United States have found that yoga may provide the same benefits in risk factor reduction as such traditional physical activities as biking and brisk walking. Quote, this finding is significant as individuals who cannot or prefer not to perform traditional aerobic exercise might still achieve similar benefits in cardiovascular risk reduction. So, if you want to have a healthier heart, and maybe it's cold out, you can't get outside, it's icy, or some inclement weather, help prevent a heart attack or stroke, do yoga. And if you can't get to a clinic or a studio, well, you can go to the internet and there are yoga classes taught there and you can just plug it into your television and follow right along. Oh, and by the way, aspartame is linked to leukemia and lymphoma in a new landmark study on humans. And for the study, researchers prospectively analyzed data from the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professionals' Follow-Up Study for 22 years, 77,218 women, 47,800 men were included in the analysis, which is 2,278,396 person years of data. So this is a huge study. And what they found was that one diet soda a day, one per day, increases leukemia and multiple myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. 42% higher leukemia risk in men and women, 102% higher multiple myeloma risk in men, and 31% higher non-Hodgkin's lymphoma risk in men. So, for those of you who thought, well, my diet soda is low in calories, no calories, what's the big deal? Well, lymphoma, leukemia, and multiple myeloma, all of those are killer cancers. Yeah, that's a big deal. Your government has lied to you, the industry has lied to you, and the media has allowed them in their ads to lie to you. We've been challenging this for decades. Stay away from all diet soda. Try the juice instead, natural juices. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break. Please stay with us. Back in a moment. Have you with us, everyone? I'm Gary Knoll, and for all of the people all over the world, we certainly appreciate that you not only listen, but you're sharing the information with others. With no advertising, no articles, no publicity, no PR at all, you have made this the number one listened to progressive radio program and station in the world, the number one listened to over the telephone in North and South America, and in the top five in the world. And more people go to our site to download important progressive-related articles than any other place. So thank you for that. And also, before we go on to some really important short pieces I'm going to do before we go to Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, I'm donating lots of stuff to WBAI to help it, and including a custom-built huge glass conference table that seats, I believe, 12. It's heavy, and it's worth thousands of dollars. I don't want to see it broken. It's packed now because we're in the process of moving, and I'm not taking it into my new office. So I've decided to donate an awful lot of stuff to WBAI to help it in its offices to get some really nice and useful furniture free of charge. So if you have a truck and you would like to help BAI, and I'm sure with Mitch Cohen and some of the volunteers, they can organize. And next week Monday, you could go and pick it all up and take it to BAI, and then the station could be able to have people there use it. That's the point of the exercise. So if you have a van or a truck, not a car, or if you'd like to volunteer, you have to be kind of strong. I don't want to see people who are not able to lift something hurt themselves. Call my office at 646-926-5422 and just give your name and phone number, and then whoever's going to be the coordinator, and I'm sure there'll be someone from BAI, we'll coordinate people, maybe get a truck or two, because I have a lot of really nice stuff I'm giving to the station. It will help the station. It'll make it more functional and dress it up also. Okay? Officials. Now, get this. I thought you'd find this interesting. This is their latest move. They are now in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual using a term called orthorexia nervosa. What is orthorexia nervosa? Eating healthy. You heard me right. If you consider healthy, clean eating to be important in your life, you are now considered to have a psychiatric official disorder. They're calling it an eating disorder, to be specific. Now, how is that possible, that being conscious and concerned about eating healthy should be a psychiatric disorder? Because remember, I've been telling you all along, they're trying to pathologize all normal behavior. And so anyone who goes out of their way to eat raw food or healthy food, now they're considering that a psychiatric brain chemical imbalance needing medication and associating with anorexia and bulimia. That's how sick our society has become. And adding into something on public health, this is from Madeline Davies of the Mail. Quote, the majority of people taking antidepressants may not actually have depression. A new study by researchers discovered that more than two-thirds, that's 69% of people taking antidepressants, did not meet the criteria for major depressive disorders, which is also known as clinical depression. Now, so keep this in mind. We're dealing with, and this was published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, so we have people who are not really depressed taking antidepressants, which then cause depression. And as I mentioned yesterday on my program, all of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil, they don't do anything that's been proven to benefit your serotonin level, because there is no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance. So if you have fatigue or loss of energy or any sense of feeling of worthlessness or guilt about something, or you have trouble making decisions, or you can't concentrate all the time, Then they say, ah, you're depressed, take the drugs. No, those are normal parts of life. So I just want to give you the latest. So when you've got over 30 million Americans diagnosed with depression and taking drugs, at least by this official survey, most of you don't need it, and hence are hurting yourself or your children by taking them. How bad is it for the average American? Well, you wouldn't know by watching the media. They think we're booming. We're not. 47% of Americans' households save nothing. Nothing whatsoever. That's half of all American households don't have a nickel saved. And then they lose their job and they go right into this gigantic hole. So shouldn't that be a primary concern of helping half the American population get out of that dark place? You bet. And also, the latest study shows that the United States is the world leader in child poverty. Quote, America's wealth grew by 60% in the last 6 years by over $30 trillion. In approximately the same time, the number of homeless children has grown by 60%. And wasn't it Peter Schiff who said people don't go hungry in a capitalist economy? Well, Peter, sorry, but 18 million children in the United States are hungry every day. And so instead of helping the families and the children, they simply demean them, denounce them, and then forget about them. So, and by the way, $5 a day for food by Congress is thought to be too much. And believe it or not, half of all food stamp recipients are children, and they average about $5 a day for their meals. And yet, they cut $8.6 billion from the food stamp program. So if you think you could have a kid eat on $2.50 a day, why don't you try it? Let's see what you can feed the kid. And it's just terrible. In fact, this winter, remember when it was so cold? The U.S. Department of Housing said that on any given night, 138,000 children had no place to go. They had no shelter. What does it say about we, the rest of us, not the corrupt politicians and the systems and the bureaucracies, which are just massive cancers that should all be completely eliminated and starting from scratch? Just huge $1 trillion payouts to all of these military and intelligence contractors and energy contractors. But we have 138,000 children on the coldest nights of the year, and they don't have a place to get warm or to sleep. And that's on no one's radar. And that's unfortunate. Let's go over now and hear from Dr. Susanna Humphreys continuing to explain her concern about safety and efficacy of vaccines. It led her to spend over, there were two people I interviewed, by the way, three. Two said they spent over 5,000 hours researching it, and one said that she spent over 8,000 and could have gone as high as 12,000 hours in studying all this, and read, all of them said they read every single article in the scientific literature, and they came to the conclusion that there is no such thing as a safer, effective vaccine for a given individual. Here's her story.
That was how history would remember it. But from 1959 through 1961, government health officials were frantically seeking means to remove a tumor-inducing factor from polio vaccines. At the same time, these health officials were also vigorously conducting a campaign to inject contaminated polio vaccines into millions of people without telling them that it contained a tumor-inducing factor. That factor has been referred to today by one of the world's leading virologists as the perfect war machine. The Division of Biologic Standards used very similar silencing and intimidation tactics on Dr. Eddy as they did on Dr. Morris. Her laboratory was downsized and her staff was removed. She had to develop innovative and time-saving ways of completing her work. So she too was shut down for her findings instead of rewarded for potentially saving many innocent people from being injected with cancer viruses. Why is Dr. Eddy important to me? That monkey virus was called SV40. And today you can read in medical journals about the tumors and kidney diseases that have been associated with that cancer-inducing virus. SV40 is something that all nephrologists should know about, but for some reason they don't. SV40 is found in both healthy and sick people of all ages today. But people with a specific type of glomerular disease called focal and segmental glomerulosclerosis, or FSGS, which is very difficult to treat, are more likely to have SV40 in their kidneys. Ask any nephrologist about the toxic drugs used to treat FSGS and what the cure rate is, and how frustrating it is for doctors and patients alike. It is documented widely in medical literature that this kidney trophic virus came from polio vaccines in the 1950s and 1960s, and since then has been documented to circulate in the human population. Humans can pass it to each other, and we can also pass it to our children before birth. Nephrologists today don't know much about SV40 because they're interested more in two related polyomaviruses called BK and JC, which become active in people given a transplant who have their immune systems suppressed. The possible role of SV40 in FSGS just doesn't come on their radar. But FSGS is a leading cause of idiopathic nephrotic syndrome, and most people with the disease eventually require dialysis. FSGS as a percent of the underlying disease among dialysis patients has increased 11-fold from 0.2% in 1980 to 2.3% in 2000. Just to give you a visual of what FSGS is, look at these images. A single kidney contains around 1 million nephrons, and each nephron has a filter. The circular images shown here are glomeruli, or filters in real life. They're spherically shaped. What you're looking at are stained cross-section images from human kidneys. The first one is normal, and the second and third ones show FSGS problems, which are obvious even to the untrained eye. The filters are not functioning properly, and proteins that should remain in the body leak out into the urine instead. Because of that, FSGS is associated with several other derangements in the body, like high blood pressure, edema, and lipid alterations. While SV40 virus is found in both healthy and sick people, it is known that a certain antigen from SV40 virus results in FSGS in experimental mice. We also know that human kidney is a reservoir of more than one strain of SV40 virus, and that people with kidney disease tend to have higher rates of SV40 viral shedding. This slide shows the rate of SV40 presence in urine and kidney of FSGS patients, patients with other kidney disease, and of normal healthy people. You can appreciate that the FSGS people have far higher rates of SV40 positivity. Just looking at urine excretion, you can see 41% of FSGS, 10% of other kidney disease, and only 4% of normals have SV40 positivity. Kidney biopsies, as previously shown, have the highest rates of infection in FSGS sufferers. We have seen a considerable increase in FSGS in kidneys between the 1970s and the late 1990s, which continues on today. Nephrologists see so much kidney injury from drugs like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, antibiotics, chemotherapy, and in my and others' experience, even vaccines. Research in animals and humans shows that SV40 can initiate kidney injury and can also render kidneys susceptible to injury. Most people recover clinically after drug insults, but how many patients are susceptible to drug-induced kidney damage because they harbor variants of SV40 in the kidney? SV40 is also thought to reactivate as a result of kidney inflammation and with kidney injury from various toxins. This is an area of research that is largely untouched. Medical articles state that SV40 virus was in vaccines only up until 1963. But Rizzo and Carboni in 1999 showed that with better testing, SV40 could have been detected in seed stock for vaccine manufacture long after 1963. Attorney Stanley Copps, in 2000, gave evidence from legal documents that there was no guarantee that SV40 was not in Letterly's polio vaccines up until the year 2000, when Copps wrote his article. FSGS, as we have just seen, is a serious potential consequence of SV40, but equally troubling is the potential for malignant kidney transformation in those who harbor SV40. Malignant transformation of normal cells infected with SV40 is a proven reality. Enders and Shine published in the 1960s that SV40 virus causes pathology and transforms human kidney cells in culture. That means that it causes disease and cancer in those cells. And Dr. Eddy showed that hamsters injected with SV40 developed kidney tumors. After 1964, the medical literature is devoid of SV40 kidney cancer research. But kidney cancers rose significantly after 1964. Look at this astonishing increase in incidence of kidney cancer in the UK. Similar trends are documented in Europe, Canada, and the USA. You may be saying, correlation doesn't equal causation. Certainly other cofactors may exist. But the research of Dr. Eddy and the finding that SV40 transforms human kidney cells is compelling. Causation was considered by Mortimer et al. In 1981 in a New England Journal of Medicine article, which summarized the results of the largest cohort of SV40-exposed children. Over 1,000 of those children were followed. They had actually traced 87% of that population of those children in 1981. Mortimer's concluding sentence says that because of mounting complexities and obstacles in tracing the subjects, cancer surveillance was terminated when they were teenagers. According to Dr. Anthony Morris, that would not have been the time to stop this study, but really to start it. Have vaccines anything to do with this trend we see as nephrologists? Because I can tell you, nephrologists and urologists have never been so busy. And business has never been so good as it is today. If you want to know why there are so many gaps in knowledge over SV40 and cancers, like kidney cancers, ask Drs. Key and Carboni. According to them and others, the controversy over the implications of SV40 damage has paralyzed the scientific research. Drs. Key and Carboni also said that SV40 was in Italy's polio vaccine supply up until 1999. Dr. Carboni expressed his thoughts about the suppression of his findings over SV40 and tumors in an interview to Bookchin and Schumacher. Unfortunately, as Drs. Eddy and Morris would tell you if they were here, you certainly can be punished for talking science, especially if it might make the public less willing to have blind faith in the safety of all vaccine programs. Let's look at another concern of mine. In order to make enough flu vaccine to vaccinate the world and do it quickly, a new way of making flu vaccines had to be developed. Making them on chick embryos, which is the old way, is too slow and time-consuming. So the new solution is Cocker Spaniel kidney cells, which were first cultured in 1958 by Maiden and Darby. Those same cells have become mysteriously immortalized. More recently, a sanitized term has been used, continuous cell lines. These cells are now deemed safe for human vaccine production. The FDA says nobody knows just how these cells were made immortal. I can only speculate, but the textbooks clearly state that an oncogenic transformation occurred and that there has been chromosomal mutation. This particular vaccine substrate just happens to be tumorigenic in humans, as stated by FDA personnel. These are screenshots from FDA documents stating that neoplastic Maiden Darby cells are used in flu vaccine production and that those cells may cause tumors in recipients. They say if the cell is not intact, it will not likely be a problem. But other FDA documents, such as PEDIN and the panel discussion among scientists in that paper, documents the real concerns discussed behind closed doors at FDA meetings regarding transferring even nanogram amounts of genetic material via injections.
And that's Dr. Susanna Humphreys. We'll continue to hear from her in two more episodes on our next program and the program after that. Again, this is a mainstream doctor who did her homework and says now she is the absolute scientific belief that there is no such thing as a safe or effective vaccine. But she's laying out her research very methodically, the proper way to do it. I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go over to Santa Cruz, California. We're standing by as Dr. Nancy Ellen Abrams. She's a philosopher and a historian. She's an attorney. And we're going to talk about how the cosmological and physical sciences should inform us about our concept of a God and its relevance in facing future challenges. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
I gave your bio in its completeness earlier at the beginning of the program, and we are on a station that is stations all across America, and we have a lot of people who would consider themselves enlightened on this matter, and we have scholars of all types. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing a lot of people supporting atheism. It's increasing, particularly in developed countries in North America and Europe, among the younger generation. It's now reaching almost 30% in the United States among the millennial generation. When we look around us at the devastation humanity is causing upon the planet, and with so many of its political and corporate instigators professing to be good abiding believers in the Judeo-Christian faith, there is good reason to deny the existence of a salvationist God and criticize its myth of the scapegoat. As Carl Jung warned about, that convicts humanity to a kind of divinely ordained slavery. We may recall in the aftermath of 2008 economic crash, Goldman Sachs chairman Lloyd Blankfein stated that he, meaning Goldman Sachs, are doing God's work. George Bush did the same, imploring us to believe that the reason he went into Iraq was he was following God's work. What sane person could believe in a God who supports multinational banking and who increases poverty and suffering and denies any personal responsibility and then financially benefits from turning families and children into the streets or kills them with drone attacks or leaves them suffering from depleted uranium? Moreover, the religions don't have a pretty history regarding wars. In fact, more people have been killed because of religious beliefs than any other concept. Throughout history, colonialism, persecution, countless deaths. And clearly we see this in the fundamentalist faith right here at home, in their rampant denialism of common sense that should be evident if they simply looked at the world and the universe, the cosmos, and nature that vibrates with aliveness and splendor all around themselves. So I'd like you to begin there, because you lived a good part of your life as an atheist, and later found that there is a crucial need for a God concept to emerge in our postmodern culture. However, it should not be a God that is contrary to science, but rather, let's say, a God that exists in partnership with and participates in the laws and principles of science. So I turn the forum over to you to share with this audience your best arguments in your journey to a revision of a God based upon the cosmology and the laws of physical sciences, such as quantum laws, that possess a concept that up to this point may have remained hidden. The forum is yours.
Okay, that's a lot to respond to. You're absolutely right, though, about atheism growing because of the real abuse of the idea of religion that many of our political leaders have been engaging in. There's no question in my mind that all of the current ways of thinking about God, that is the traditional ways of thinking about God, are inadequate for our time and in many ways destructive. It was possible for everybody in the world to think that their God was universal when they never had any contact with people outside their community or their culture. But now that we are basically a fully wired planet and everyone is in contact with everyone else, when people claim that their God and their sense of morality is universal and therefore everyone else is wrong and in some cases deserves to be killed for it, this is the kind of situation that could destroy our whole species in the longer term. We cannot hang on to a pre-scientific notion of God in an age when we know so much and we have such powerful technology. Now, I think actually that atheism is a reasonable response to the kind of God that has been taught to most of us. But here's what I am actually proposing. I think that the concept of God is not going to go away. God is probably the most powerful concept that the human mind has. Everybody over the age of 2 or 3 has some kind of notion of God. And it represents something to us, which very often we can't define, but we still want and seek. And it's a higher level of aspiration. And that is not going away. What I think we need to do is take back this word, God, and say, what exactly do we really mean by it? What do we need from it? And what is the baggage that people have added over the centuries that we don't need? And the main baggage is all of the things that are completely incoherent, things that are inconsistent with what we now know scientifically. I think what we need to do is to take science as a model. Now, what science can do is it can't tell us what the truth is, but science can rule out the impossible. The reason it can't tell us what the truth is because sometime in the future, some new discovery could rule that out. But it can certainly rule out errors. So, for example, Galileo completely ruled out the possibility that Earth was the center of the universe and surrounded by crystal spheres, which is what people believed in the Middle Ages. He ruled that out, but he wasn't actually able to prove that the Earth goes around the sun. And that's how science progresses. When it rules out something, you just have to let it go. Just let it go because it's over. There's no point in arguing. What if we did that with the idea of God? What if we just looked at the attributes that people just assume God has and said, which of these are impossible? Let's just let go of the impossible ones. What would be left? So, for example, in my book, A God That Could Be Real, I choose 5 of the main characteristics that people associate with a traditional God, and I show why each of them is simply impossible in the kind of universe we live in. Let me take a step back and say that I am married to one of the scientists that has discovered the modern picture of the universe, who has promulgated the theory of cold dark matter. And this theory basically tells us that our universe is not what anybody expected it to be. It's not all made of atoms, as everyone assumed. It turns out that everything that we can see, all of the stars, the dust, the planets, all of the distant galaxies, everything visible in all wavelengths of light, totals less than half of 1% of what's actually out there. What's going on in the universe is completely controlled on the large scale by 2 invisible, shall we call them, presences. One is dark matter, which is a kind of matter which is not made of atoms or the parts of atoms, quite mysterious, and the other is dark energy. And that is the energy that is causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. The competition between these 2 things, the dark matter and the dark energy, over billions of years has spun the galaxies into being. This is why there are galaxies. And galaxies are the only possible homes for the evolution of planets and life. So really, we owe our very existence to these strange things that no one knew about, no one even dreamed about before the 20th century. So there are all kinds of implications of that theory. They go forward and backward, backward in time, I mean, and forward in time. And we live in a universe which no religious teacher could ever have imagined. But now we know. And so we have to start rethinking everything that we thought about the universe as a whole, including the idea that God created it. So the ideas that I've picked out specifically, there are probably more, but five big ones that I think are impossible in the universe as we understand it scientifically are that God existed before the universe. Because the way we understand the universe is that everything complex evolves out of a simpler state of being. So there couldn't have been something so complex that it could plan a universe before evolution even began. So God could not have existed before the universe or created it. It can't know everything. Omniscience is not even a meaningful concept in a relativistic universe where things are different for people traveling at different speeds relative to each other, and it's not a matter of perception. It really is different. God can't plan the future of the entire universe and the future of every person, and God can't violate the laws of nature. Now, I know that this sometimes strikes people as saying, well, then you've just eliminated everything God could possibly be, but that's not true at all. I've eliminated the things that God can't be. What's left? What really matters to us about God? This is what we need to think about. And what really matters is that God be able to inspire us, to give us hope, to inculcate a big new perspective in us, to bind us to each other, to show us our ties to our planet, to our past, our future, our descendants, our ancestors, and give us common ground enough so that we can solve global problems. A God like that would be far more valuable than any traditional God and completely consistent with science. So, Gary, I don't know if you want me to just keep going on like this or you want to ask me some questions, but I can explain what is.
We only have 4 minutes, so I want you to go to what you believe is your best argument for us to consider for why there is a God presence.
Here's my picture of God. Let me just give you an analogy. It's much easier to explain that. If there is an ant colony, ants are extremely simple creatures. They don't really understand what they're doing. All they can know how to do is follow pheromone trails, and that's about it. But if you put thousands and thousands of them together, the ant colony has extremely sophisticated abilities. It can build an anthill taller than a man without a single ant engineer or architect. It can judge how many ants should be out there foraging, how many should be on trash collection, how many should be on childcare, how many should be soldiers competing with other ant colonies. And yet no ant gives orders and no ant takes orders. What happens is there's something called emergence. Emergence is a phenomenon that rises throughout nature where when there's a complicated situation with many, many, many parts, if you step way back and look at the whole, a completely new phenomenon will emerge from the whole, and that is the ant colony, which is very different from any ant. The same thing happens with humans. Your body, for example, is 90% cells that are not human. We, each of us, is a community of many, many, many microbes that do really all the work inside ourselves, like producing energy and digesting food. But we, as individual, as human beings, we are emergent phenomena from all of this complexity going on within us. And my idea of God is that God is an emergent phenomenon that has arisen from the staggering complexity of all of humanity's aspirations interacting and causing them to have ideas and language and communities, rituals, music, all the things that people have created that none of our primate ancestors had. And these things emerge into something which is real. This kind of God can be real because emergent phenomena are real, even though this kind of God is not human, but it's real, just like I'm real, even though I'm not a microbe. Now, this may sound just intellectual, but the fact of the matter is that when you play this idea out, it has fabulous implications across the board for how we can see each other, for how we see ourselves, what we see ourselves as human beings. We are participants in many emergent phenomena. For example, the economy is an emergent phenomenon. The government, science, art, all these things, you can't define exactly what they are, but they have all emerged from the incredible complexity of many, many humans interacting in certain areas of behavior. So this kind of a God actually, let me put it this way, this God did not create the universe, but it created the meaning of the universe, because meaning is a collective phenomenon. And if God had not emerged later in this way, the universe would be completely meaningless. It wouldn't even be a universe, because that's a concept, and there wouldn't be any concepts, there wouldn't be any ideas. So this kind of God is powerful and does affect us. The aspirations of the people who've gone before us tremendously affect us, have enormous power over us. And we have power over those who are here today and will be here in the future through God. So I know in a few minutes I don't have the time to explain this, but I do
You know
do
what I'm
going to
do, Nancy, what I'm going to do is I'm going to invite you back for part two, because I believe that we should be looking at something other than God. I believe we should be looking at spirituality. And this is not just a cultural definition that was dominant in the younger people in the 60s and 70s, which does not exist today. It's considered too esoteric. Young people today don't care much about any of that. Instead, how you walk your talk is how they define you spiritually. Do you protect the environment or not? Are you standing up for gender, sexual, and racial and civil justice or not? Do you have courage to stand up against repressive powers of greed and wealth or not? And then that's how they judge. But there's something else involved, and I want to talk about it in depth, not in an abbreviated way, and that is an energy that we have yet to define as a collective whole, individuals have, that allows us to connect with others, the universe, and universal energies. So we will come back and talk about this, and I'm not referring to the universal laws like Pythagorean theory or gravity or the existence of DNA. I'm talking about something that is far more essential to us as human beings. So join me for a part two, an extended version of this discussion, all right?
Thank you.
So NancyEllenAbrams.com is her website. A book, A God That Could Be Real, Spirituality, Science, and the Future of Our Planet. But we will continue this with a more in-depth discussion. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.